for WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Two of the main Republican contenders to challenge Democrat Tim Kaine met in a debate over the weekend. Charlottesville will begin streaming city council meetings live on Facebook, part of the city's new effort to be more transparent in its public business. And award-winning author Sam Quiñones discusses America's opiate epidemic. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, March 19th.
Support for the WMRA Daily is provided by the Shops at Stonefield at Route 29 and Hydraulic Road in Charlottesville, featuring a collection of shopping, dining, and entertainment experiences with ample parking. Learn more at shopsatstonefield.com.
Two of the main contenders for the Republican U.S. Senate nomination clashed in the first debate of the June 12th primary. Corey Stewart, a candidate for governor last year, and State Delegate Nick Freitas of Culpeper, met on Saturday for a debate before the Virginia Tea Party in Richmond. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that Stewart, chairman of the Prince William County Board of Supervisors, tried to portray Freitas as politically inexperienced. Freitas said Stewart has divided the Republican Party and has, quote, some problems with the truth from time to time. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine is seeking a second term in the Senate after his 2016 loss in the presidential election as Hillary Clinton's running mate. Charlottesville City Council meetings, held on the first and third Mondays of each month, will now be streamed live on Facebook per a pilot program that began earlier this month. The Daily Progress reports that on Monday, City Communications Director Brian Wheeler will give a presentation on the pilot program and other communications initiatives the city is considering in response to the council's request for more robust public engagement. More than 42,000 Americans died of opioid overdoses alone in 2016, a 28% increase over 2015. In his 2015 book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, award-winning journalist Sam Quiñones detailed the major causes of the crisis. Mr. Quiñones is participating in a safety conference at James Madison University this week. Before his visit to our area, he spoke with me by phone, and I began by asking him about the spread of black tar heroin from the western U.S. to the Midwest and Appalachia, and how the illicit heroin dealers from one remote part of Mexico learned to take advantage of the mass marketing of prescription painkillers such as OxyContin. They were using an unusual delivery method that he compared to delivering pizza.
Basically, the system that these guys from this one little town figured out was a delivery system, very much like pizza delivery, where you were an addict, you would call a number, and this number would be a guy in an apartment somewhere. He would be ordering about a series of drivers. There'd be three or four drivers per crew, usually. This would these drivers would drive around town constantly all day long, 7 days a week. And their mouths full of little balloons of heroin. They'd have usually another larger stash hidden somewhere in the car. And the addict would call the number. The dispatcher would call the driver. The driver would tell the dispatcher would tell the driver where to meet the addict, and they arrange to meet each other. So these guys had to find new markets. So once one market was saturated, they would have to then move on to find other markets. They were the first ones to figure out that there was an enormous new heroin market coming, bigger than anything they'd ever been able to discover in the western side of the United States, because they landed in Columbus, Ohio in 1998. And Columbus, Ohio was then pretty much like the ground zero for promotion of narcotic pain pills by pharmaceutical companies, doctors promoting very heavily to doctors that these were pills that they needed to use and needed to prescribe their patients, that they were now risk-free, no addiction for people who were suffering from pain. And the massive promotion of these pills and therefore the massive prescribing of these pills, huge new unprecedented amounts of these pills, and a lot of those pills ending up in the black market, began to create new heroin addicts, because people would switch from the pills, which were very expensive, to heroin. Well, these guys discovered that first. What's happening now, began to happen in large numbers, really, in about 2010, 11, 12, 13, right in there. These guys were onto, they saw that market beginning to form in 1998, 99, when they arrived in Columbus, just as pharmaceutical companies, particularly Purdue Pharma, was very, very aggressively promoting these pills in that region, Ohio, West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, places like that.
And it's almost like the pharmaceutical companies sort of came up with the product or a new kind of product, and then the heroin dealers came in kind of with a knockoff, and it was cheaper, and in many ways it was more potent, right?
It's about as potent, or eventually got more potent. They stopped cutting it quite so much, and yeah, it's cheaper. And of course, they provided something else that was essential for an addict, and that is a way of assuring that you will always get your dope every day and exactly when you need it, because they have this very efficient delivery service. And so if you're an addict, one of the biggest problems you face is, where am I going to get my drugs every day? A lot of people had to go to very suspect motels or some skid row place,
right,
or a housing project or something. These guys said, no, we will bring it to you close to wherever you live. And so all of a sudden, it's an enormous convenience for addicts. They no longer have to go traipsing around the town looking for dope. They'll bring it to a gas station or the Target parking lot that's right around the corner from them or something like that. And that is another thing that these guys added: customer service, convenience, that nobody had really brought to many of these markets where they landed all across the country as they expanded.
It's hard to discuss the drug issue without discussing race, and you touch on some of that in your book, and how as middle-class white kids became the face of addiction to pills and then to heroin, late 90s and in the early 2000s, and lots of them died of overdoses, the public attitude toward drugs changed, including that of lots of politicians whose tough approach to crime began to change. Can you say a little bit more about that and compare it to, say, the crack epidemic of the 1980s?
Well, yes, there was a change. It took a long time to happen, though, because for many years, and this was a festering problem for 20 years, it didn't really get noticed initially, first of all, because I think it affected kids from Appalachia. And, that's a place where we're used to ignoring, frankly, as Americans. But then, as it affected more and more middle-class white folks, they tried very, very hard to keep it quiet. They didn't want people to know this. They didn't want folks to know that their children were addicted or died that way. And so it was hidden for a long time, largely by the will of the people the families who were involved in it, because they were so mortified. They were so ashamed. As years passed, though, particularly I would say in the last 2 or 3 years, you begin to see those families coming out of the shadows in a very big way. So you begin to see obituaries now telling the truth, not saying my son or boy died of a heart attack at home at 25, but rather, you know, due to the addiction, lost his fight with addiction, this kind of thing. You see these now fairly commonly, I would say. Began to see a whole lot more public talking about this and awareness on the part of this. And as part of that, a lot of these folks, I assume many of them, once having voted for politicians who were extraordinarily tough on crime, build more prisons, throw away the key, they began to change, because now it's their kids getting addicted. And they can see the utter damage, the horrible damage, lifelong damage that a felony record creates, for example. And so in time, their politicians begin to change in a lot of areas, very red areas, in fact. You really couldn't get elected anything as a Democrat, but you also, after a while, couldn't get elected as a Republican if you were not espousing some kind of compassionate approach to this problem. Yes, again, this was very different from the way we dealt with the crack problem, which was in the 1980s, primarily early 90s, building more prisons and throwing away the key, in a sense. I would say there's a big, big difference, though, in this problem as opposed to the crack epidemic. We did not focus on treatment back then. There was no focus on treatment. And there's a racial component to that. There's also, however, the big issue of violence. With the crack epidemic, it was the violence that was the problem more than almost the drug itself. It was neighborhoods besieged by drive-by shootings, by carjackings. So you had this very public nature of violence to this whole problem that was not seen during this problem with this epidemic. So during crack, really, I covered crack cocaine, pretty much the first job I had, For 4 years, I was a crime reporter in a town that was overwhelmed by it. I don't remember anybody saying, gee, we need more treatment. Mm-hmm. I don't remember anybody in the Latino or Black communities, which were very large in that town, saying, gee, we need more treatment. There may have been a few, but really mostly it was get these guys off the streets. So there are differences, and it's a complicated story. It's not so easy to – it's nuanced, let's put it that way.
Sam Quiñones is the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Mr. Quiñones, 3 years on now after publication almost, this is a book that I should say, unfortunately, is still very relevant. Thanks very much for joining me to talk about it.
On the contrary, thanks, Bob, and I'll look forward to seeing you guys out there in Harrisonburg.
Sam Quiñones will be in Harrisonburg Tuesday evening for a bonus Books and Brews at Pale Fire Brewing Company in Harrisonburg. Be sure to join us and learn more at WMRA.org, where you can also hear much more of that phone interview with him. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your Monday.